Welcome back to Call Time with Katie Birnbaum. I'm so excited about our first episode of 2024, and I think you will be too, because we have a genuine celeb on the podcast. My guest got his start with professional acting. I'm playing the Little Prince with New York City Opera at Lincoln Center. The New York Times called his performance then smashing. From there, he began an illustrious career. He starred in A Christmas Carol, the musical, The Ten Commandments, the musical at the Kodak in LA, and of course in Jason Robert Brown's musical 13 on Broadway. He's no stranger to the silver screen. In addition to Broadway and opera, he co-starred in the film Evan Almighty and in 7 seasons of The Good Wife, a show that I really loved. He also starred in the 2018 film Blockers, played Nick St. Clair in the 2nd season of Riverdale, and combined both of these passions for stage and screen by playing Prince Eric in The Little Mermaid Live. My guest co-founded Grind Arts Company together with my other dear friend and friend of the pod, Eamon Foley, a project with which I have been involved as well. And he and his brother started a film production company through which they've written and directed films like The Mediator, The Bygone, and Rumble Through the Dark, which starred Bella Thorne. Somehow through all this, my guest also got a degree in history from Princeton University, where perhaps his most important credit, we were in the first Princeton class I ever took, an incredible freshman seminar on German film score composers. There's so much more to say about this amazing person. We've already been chatting. He even surprised me. I thought we were recording remotely. This is classic, this person. I thought we were recording remotely. He called and he was like, I have a surprise. And he's here with his amazing dog. So without further ado, please welcome to the show, Graham Phillips.
Hello.
You said you don't like praise. Was that like really painful for you?
It actually was really nice.
I'm so glad.
Yeah, I'm just like, wow, I've actually done more than I thought I have.
I'm so glad. Maybe 2024 is about claiming your praise, owning it. You should.
Yeah, just like really, just starting to brag a bit more.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Yeah. Healthy, humble bragging, as they say. By the way, Graham's dog Blue perked up completely when I was introducing all your credits and then immediately fell back to sleep.
Yeah, she always gets a bit schmaltzy when anyone's talking about me.
How could she not? Now she's staring at me. Graham.
Yeah.
Is this your first podcast ever?
I thought it was my first podcast. I think I did one podcast interview for my last gig was a video game that I did. I acted in Spider-Man 2 and I was interviewed by like a gaming the faces behind the voice or something. It's like specifically for voiceover actors who do video games. So unfortunately this is my second podcast.
Damn it.
But we can just say it's my first.
I don't know. Imagine there's a lot of crossover in my listeners and the actors behind the voice
for the video game. I'd be surprised.
Were you a big video game player before you got this gig?
No. That was actually one of the weird things about the game. Everyone in the game was obsessed with video games and Spider-Man and Marvel and comic books. And I just was care less. I cared because...
It's nice to work.
It was nice to work, and I wanted to get into the story, but I had no idea what people were talking about half the time, and they couldn't believe I hadn't played the first game. And
wow.
And I just...
You're like, did you watch, what was that show with Pedro Pascal?
Narcos?
No, the other one on HBO, based on the video game.
Oh, The Last of Us.
Yes. Did you watch that?
I watched the pilot.
Yeah. There was some interview he gave. I don't know anything about video games, but that was supposed to be like the most famous video game of all time or something. And he had never played it and was just, guess I'll just do this role.
Yeah, me and Pedro.
You guys are two peas in a pod.
Yeah.
We've
admired each other from afar for quite a while.
Yeah. Similar vibes. You're both lovely, so I hear. Okay, I want to start at the beginning.
Okay.
Some would say a very good place to start. Because I know you.
Because I know you.
Yes, exactly. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I know that Would you say you grew up in a theater family? What was your first exposure to theater? Or was it music?
It was music for me. Before we officially started, we were talking about how I had a problem child streak when I was a little child.
Yeah.
And my mom discovered that for whatever reason, when I was singing, I just kind of calmed down a bit and had a place to put all my chutzpah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And yeah, so she got me singing lessons. I think I was six or something like that. And I really liked it. And I started singing at school. I did school plays. And then I started to complain that the kids and I was in kindergarten. Mm. Actually, my first role was in Annie. I was star to be.
A male star to be?
I didn't know that it was the other way around, so it seemed perfectly natural to me.
I love that. I hope there's a video of that somewhere.
There is. I couldn't pronounce my R's and I had a lisp.
Oh, I thought that was so cute, though.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Your voice hadn't broken, so I'm sure you were singing in the...
$3, two bags, one knee.
God, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone just ate it up. I was complaining that the kids in kindergarten like weren't taking it seriously enough.
Yeah,
which is just a laugh because I really didn't take much seriously at all. Also just I was a kindergartner, so it's an absurd stance to take.
Yeah.
And then my mom was like, yeah, it's a school play. Whatever. And then I kept complaining through third grade, and she's like, if you really want to, you can audition for Laguna Beach Playhouse is doing a production of Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day, and they're looking for someone who's 8-9 years old. And we booked. And I loved it. And on closing night, I was bawling my eyes out. I thought I'd never be able to do the thing again. And I asked my mom, I was like, how can I do this more? And then she said, we can wait for, they'll do another show at some point. Maybe have, you can play a role in something they're doing. And then 6 months later, she walked in and I was Googling agents for kids, or Ask Jeeving or whatever it was.
Wow, Bing.
Bing.
And the rest is history.
The rest is history.
Were you Alexander?
I was Alexander.
Wow. Yeah. So you went from star to be to the titular role.
Yeah.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Okay, so you thought the kids didn't really take it seriously, so you were like, I have to do professional theater. You were Googling agents. I'm so glad your mom discovered you, because I feel like that could have led down a very bad path, meeting some very weird people. Did she cave and say, let's meet some agents? Is that how the rest transpired?
I can get attracted to things and then burn out. I've had a lot of hobbies. Last month it was stained glass. I made two stained glass pieces and now it's done. I had a pottery wheel. I made one pot and I was like, yeah, okay, that was cool. And I'm done with pottery. So Epicurean when it comes to experiences. So my mom wasn't like, oh, he was Googling agents for kids. Let's get the kid an agent. It was another like 6 months of, is this going to stick?
This is clearly stuck. This is your life's passion.
Yeah, it did end up sticking. My dad, I think, had an entertainment lawyer at the firm that he worked at. And my parents had no idea. My dad's a judge. My mom was an attorney. The last person who really sang in my family was my grandfather, who I never met, who I found out when I went to my grandmother's funeral and I saw his grave. It said, the gift of voice on his grave. And I was like, what's that about? She's like, oh, he was a singer and he passed like right around the time that you were conceived. And so I was like, okay, got it. My mom was like, I always believed that like his voice like kind of came...
That's beautiful.
It's like, yeah, it was as touching as it was disturbing to
right.
hear.
So you came into it through singing. I feel like kids who like to sing musical theater is like the way that they develop this passion.
Mm-hmm.
I would say you should speak for yourself that one of your other passions, certainly as you've grown older and become an adult, is film and writing and directing and working in that medium. When did that become a passion? Was that always alongside, or was that later in life?
That's a good question. I always loved cameras.
Mm.
5 years old, would love just... I was devastated to learn recently that my mom didn't put film in my cameras until I was like 10 years old. I remember we went on this trip and we were somewhere in Kenya where there was giraffes. I think it's called Giraffe Manor. It's become like really popular with influencers now. We'll go take pictures with giraffes and stuff. Back when it was cool and I was five, I snuck out and I had this Tony the Tiger plastic film camera and I went out and I remember distinctly like sneaking out at night and like getting pictures of these giraffes, which I'm sure was like super dangerous looking back, taking flash photography, like point blank range of a giraffe. But I asked my mom earlier this year, where are those photos? She's like, oh, sweetheart, we didn't put film in your camera until you were like 12 years old. I'm like, oh, great. But anyways, I loved cameras. I loved like taking like videos and whatnot. I could never piece it together. I didn't have the patience to really help with the storytelling. That's where my brother comes in, who actually is moniker in the family, whereas mine was Graham the Destroyer, his was Patient Parker.
That's nice. I wish my moniker was Patience.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Mine too.
Yeah.
And I guess it was my freshman, sophomore year of college. We started writing something together, like a little short film, and with Patient Parker's key virtue, we made it through, and we realized that we make a good team. We complement each other in a lot of ways, and I can fulfill my desire to go and be like a light pirate going around grabbing imagery, and he helps it have that through line, which is something that I've gotten better at since I was 10 years old. But yeah, I think that's how it happened. We never really discussed it, though. I was talking to Parker about it a month or so ago. I was like, when did we decide to do this? And he's like, I don't know. We didn't even talk about it. We just started doing it.
Sometimes the best things in life, I think, begin that way. Did you and Eamon discuss starting Grind, or was it just, we got to do Sweeney Todd, let's make it work?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that was project-based. We just wanted to do something creatively, and there wasn't a container that existed to help make it happen, which is exactly what happened with Parker. We're like, we want to make a short film, and we were like, well, how do you find a short film script?
Yeah.
We need something to shoot. And we had to write something, and just out of necessity.
I was going to ask this question later, but I'll ask it now because it seems relevant. I was looking at your work and researching, and you obviously are a very successful actor, but I think you're somewhat unique in this sense amongst actors because you seem to have this entrepreneurial spirit. Because of these two companies, one a production company, one sort of a theater company with which you're involved. Do you think of yourself in that way? And was that a conscious choice, or is that just like a product of, as you say, this desire to be like creating things all the time, having lots of different hands and different pots?
I do think some of it is from some sort of underlying restlessness.
It's hard. I don't know how you feel. I certainly found it when I was like trying to be an actor in the city, just the lack of control of waiting around for your next big part is crazy. Was it any of that?
Yeah, I think a lot of it was some semblance of destiny control, always being on the other side of the gatekeeper and singing for your supper to try to get the opportunity to do what you want to do is obviously really hard. I know that a lot of the best actors, when they talk about auditioning, they say the day that everything changed for them was when they stopped auditioning, when they treated the room like that. That is the opportunity to do the work, and that's like full stop. And I think that's really healthy, and I've definitely gotten better at that, getting over that resentment that can come with like, I'm doing all this work and it might not lead to anything. You say that you want to do this, and now you're getting to do it, and you're saying you're not doing it as you're doing it. So there's some of it's that, but that's also really hard to do all the time and just be in a great place. At the end of the day, it's nice to feel like, you know, have your hand on the controls of your life a little bit. So some of it's that. I have noticed, though, that with my hand in the filmmaking bucket, my hand in the acting bucket, my hand increasingly going back into the music bucket, which I'm very excited about, there's been, and this even happened at Princeton, where I will hesitate to put all my chips on one color.
Yeah.
I remember when I was doing The Good Wife, there was a sort of sense that I'm not really, I'm an actor, but really I'm a Princeton student, and who knows what I'm going to end up doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then at Princeton, it was like, yeah, I'm here, but like, really, I'm an actor.
Yeah.
And it's just a way of not really showing up for my life appointment.
So interesting.
And there's so much to be said for specializing and sticking with something and going much deeper. When it seems like you've reached bedrock, and then you stick around a little longer,
mm-hmm.
that's when the really interesting stuff starts happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I realized that when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm starting to realize that it's not just about staying busy and making all the projects happen. There's something else that's alchemized when you just sit with the same thing for a moment.
Do you feel pressure from the industry to decide what or who you are?
I think that a lot of people don't really know what to do with me. Even when I've been talking to reps about getting help on the lit side or getting representation as directors,
mm-hmm.
there's a hesitancy to come up with a game plan because it does. I don't really fit in the box. I don't think it's just like the multi-hyphenate thing. It's okay, so you, when you do things, you do it like once every like few years and you'll be the lead in something. On the acting side, it's weird like how to cast me. It's been unusual for people. They're like, okay, like, what is it? What supporting roles would you even be good at? And then the roles where they're like, yeah, that would be a great role for you. They're like these leading roles that are so hard to get.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's a cool place to be, but it's also, there's one or two films every couple of years that really are the ones that mold the music and
mm-hmm.
the acting in a way that, and the story that in a way that I find really inspiring. And it's everyone's got their crosshairs on that same role. So it's just, that's a challenge. But then you add on the writing and the direct, it just gets so amorphous. Like people are like, what do I even do with this? Just tell me what the hell it is that you do and then I can help you with that. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, I think it'd be easier if I was a little bit more defined.
I think it's cool. I purposefully try to or often interview people on the show who do multiple things within entertainment because I do multiple things and because I find it interesting. And I do think that the industry, through no fault of their own, as you're saying, have trouble processing or even, as you say, reps working in your favor when they don't know how to place you or where to put you. On that subject, also when I was thinking about you and making my little outline, you were a child actor, a very successful child actor, and a very successful teen actor, and now you are an adult. We are adults, much as it might not seem that way. And I think people talk a lot about the inability of child or teen actors to transition into more adult roles. I feel like you were able to do it pretty successfully. Do you have that perception? Is that something you think about or have thought about a lot? Because I also wonder, maybe there are roles, correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like there are also roles that you have to grow into still.
Yeah, for sure. I actually feel like I've been at a hard age. I think that like the 25 to 30 age is tough. I'm not exactly sure why. I think because it's a little too young to really be like the leading man, like the archetype of the man as far as society is concerned. That's just not, people that my age aren't quite formed enough.
Yeah.
And then just being a little too old for the normal coming of age genre.
Yeah.
There are roles out there, but they're really for Timothy Chalamet. Let's be real.
Yeah, it's true. Have you ever wished you looked older? Because I feel like you look young.
Yeah, I still think I look young. I feel like I won't be playing men until I'm like 35.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is like what Ryan Gosling was doing when he was 30. I don't think that like visually I'm really gonna be there until I'm like 35.
Yeah. Or even like on stage, like I was trying to think, you could play the baker now.
Doing Sunday in the Park with George in Pasadena changed a bit of how I perceived what I could do. It made me just like doing the research into what Surratt had been through, and mm-hmm. 26 when he died.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I just assumed Surratt, just the way that he'd been played. Oh, he's 40.
I thought he was like 40s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was, oh, everyone's actually been like far too old. But then I was thinking about it and looking at what life was like in 1870s, 80s. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah, you grew up way faster, even though he was still like very connected to his mom and had a sort of strange infancy thing going on there. Like he was just, adulthood was very different than it is now.
There was no sort of teenage dumb back in the day / young adult. Like,
yeah, you were already an apprentice and you were like figuring out your trade.
Exactly.
Because you lived until 40 years old or 50 years old.
Yeah. And if you were a woman, you were getting married and having babies by the time you were like 17, realistically.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting. That makes me think about, we've obviously skipped over a bunch of stuff, but I've always been curious, and even as I mentioned, you were one of the first people I met at Princeton. Why Princeton? You had already done 13. You were already on The Good Wife. A, why Princeton over, say, a conservatory, like a Juilliard or whatever? Was that just, oh, I'm already working, that doesn't matter? / why college at all?
I think that college over conservatory was a lot to do with where I was socially. I'd been homeschooled for 4 years while doing The Good Wife.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
By one of your parents or like a tutor?
No, I had a few tutors. I think I had a really good setup. Like I really loved how I was able to learn.
Yeah.
But I was also in New York and I didn't know anyone. And like, how are you supposed to meet people in New York if you're not in school?
Yeah.
I remember joining like a tennis club at one point, being like, maybe I'll meet people there. I'm like, what am I, like in my 70s? And anyway, so I think that I just really craved like a normal social environment. Like I was working with adults. And
yeah.
So I really wanted that. But I do look back, and I had such a great time at Princeton. And one of the reasons why I went, my sister went there, and I just thought the campus was gorgeous. I thought going somewhere in the city. I was still doing The Good Wife, so I drew a 2-hour circle around New York where we were filming and was looking at the colleges there. I think a part of it was, I know how distracted I can be. And if I was, you know, NYU or Columbia or somewhere, and I was in the city, mm-hmm. I think I just knew that I'd have a hard time really focusing on my studies.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, there's something in the air at Princeton that just, it makes you excited to go deep and stuff and go into an old library and underneath the stained glass. And
maybe you're not done with your stained glass hobby. You've mentioned it twice.
Yeah, I actually have a project underway.
I can't wait to hear about it.
I'll tell you all about it later. But there's a part of me that wishes that I had dedicated more of myself to getting, just honing in on my craft, on the acting side and on the singing side. I think there was a little bit of, I don't know if it was conceit or if it was just like not.
I think you're being hard on yourself.
I probably am. I do feel compassionate towards little Graham.
Yeah.
I think he did great things. And
yeah.
His curiosity has gotten me to look at things in a continually evolving way, and I love that. But I look back and I was playing it so safe at that time with acting on The Good Wife. I was really not wanting to make mistakes. And I think what really would have been good for me is going into an environment where that was really encouraged.
Mm.
And I think that there's just a part of me that was like, I'm doing everything right. I'm doing a good job. And I didn't really understand that what I was actually doing was learning to hate acting.
Oh, no.
Which was so bizarre because there were so many unbelievable guest stars on The Good Wife that came from theater backgrounds mm-hmm. at filming out here. Alan Cumming or Nathan Lane, like they were so dynamic and explosive and so the opposite of just get it right, don't make the mistake. They were playing. I remember Alan Cumming, before he would go on set or before action was called, he'd be making all sorts of weird sounds and just be doing weird shit. And I was, what is he doing? And looking back, I'm like, oh my God, like that's what I needed. It just getting obliterating the filter at that time was what I needed. I needed to like.
How have you sought that since?
Some of it's just been like inquiry and therapy, like looking at where the hell, like the filtering and the need to be perfect and not make a mistake comes from. But that sort of thinking and that kind of talk therapy stuff, I think it only goes so far, at least for me. I went to this men's retreat at Esalen that was like a Five Rhythms retreat, which is like...
You have to explain what that is.
Yeah. Oh, which part? Esalen, Five Rhythms, men's retreat?
All of it. All of it.
So Esalen is a retreat center in Big Sur in California. It was founded on the sacred site of the Esalen tribe. And in the 60s and 70s, it was this hub for the human potential movement. Huxley, Alan Watts, Ram Dass, Ida Rolf. They all were hanging out there and they'd show up for a week and then stay for 5 or 10 years and do a lot of their most famous work there. It's a really special place and you can go and do workshops, and they do all kinds of workshops. Stained glass, for instance, mosaics, but they also will do like more intense stuff. Like I was there once and there was a grief yoga workshop going on for people that were deep in grief, like helping move things around. And I learned about when I first went there, I went there for a concussion that I had and I needed to go on brain rest as per my neurologist.
How did you get your concussion?
I was skiing. I was holding a cappuccino in between the lodges and I slipped and
yeah, hit my head. That'll do it.
That'll do it.
I thought it was going to be like on set.
No.
Do all your own stunts kind of thing. Have you ever had to do a stunt?
Yeah. Yeah, the Western, my brother and I did, the Bygone, I did a lot of the stunts there. A lot of it was like bareback horse riding.
That's cool.
That was fun.
Back to the men's retreat.
Okay, yeah, so Esalen's this great place. Where was I?
You saw people doing grief yoga.
Oh, yeah, I learned about the Enneagram there, like that's...
Oh, yes.
Which has helped me a lot, and then...
What type are you again?
Type 7. Or the six wing, and which is the enthusiast, is like what it's called, or the epicure.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I wonder what I am. I have to take the test. How did your experience there affect your approach to acting?
Yeah, so the workshop that I'd signed up for, the center of the workshop was Five Rhythms, which is this dance modality, not unlike ecstatic dance, but it basically it just takes you through these different rhythms that are modeled after the ocean. The different phases of a wave, from gliding to staccato, or like the crest of a wave to the crash of the wave, chaos, lyrical, which is like what happens after the crash, and then stillness. And each dance session was, I don't know, maybe like between 30 and 45 minutes. And I signed up for it because I've had an unusual relationship with dance. It's hard to really let loose if you're monitoring yourself, and so that's been a challenge for me, and I think it's a challenge for a lot of people in society. We don't typically dance unless we're drunk or if we're expressing like joy or in a really celebratory environment, but historically we were all tribal peoples when we go back far enough, and dance was very much a part of like how we processed everything, like all of our emotions, and reconciling the logical conscious mind with the undercurrents and the subconscious mind and everything that I was trying to get back in touch with. And anyways, for this week, it was just really special to start moving again in a way that felt in some ways childlike, in some ways more in touch with my sense of masculinity than I'd really ever been in touch with. And I think it was also really special for me to do it in a men's group. The only experience I'd had in a men's group was a fraternity, which is a different kind of, not exactly a bastion of vulnerability. And so it was really special to go through that with a lot of men that were going through all different kinds of phases of their lives and like the whole gambit of the emotional spectrum. And so just like making friends with the essential part of myself that doesn't judge itself as it's coming to fruition,
right.
and seeing dance as a creative act, it just did wonders for putting that monitor to bed for a while.
It's really nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like shocking how, like how quickly, like just from the very first session, I think that it was a testament that just how badly I knew I needed to let go of a lot of this stuff. It just started to melt away and I was shocked by what came up. And I started to understand more, like when people talk about acting or performance or songwriting, like the capacity of letting something else run through you and letting yourself be surprised by what comes up. Finally experiencing that in a way that was just made me feel so much more alive and so much more present. And it was just such a gift to realize that it's something that I can integrate into my life, because there's groups everywhere that do this kind of stuff. If you told me like a few years ago that I'd be doing anything like this, I'd think you're crazy. It really has helped just get out of the self-consciousness and feel how good it can be.
Have you figured out any strategies or like small pieces of your experience that you have been able to incorporate into your acting process or even your directing or writing process? Or is it more of a shift in state of mind?
Pretty much every morning as part of my routine before I meditate or do pretty much anything, like I'll put on music and I'll like move. Because I've been meditating for a while, but I realized through this retreat, the way that I've been meditating and I've been journaling and I've been doing all of this stuff to help myself self-regulate, mm-hmm. which is great, has been in a sort of monastic way where I'm almost reinforcing the idea that I am something that needs to be controlled, as opposed to seeing the act of journaling and meditating and whatever else as an undoing and as a sort of homecoming of sorts, as a releasing of something essential in myself. And so that sort of turned it all on its head, where I was like, oh, I've been meditating and doing all this stuff as a way of keeping my shit together and not being like, not being too angry, or just trying to keep a sense of ease, and it's all good, we're all peaceful, I'm really patient and I'm good. When in reality, what's been in the background begging to come out is this wild child that has been like, yeah, that's all very well, but what about me? I'm not going anywhere. I'm just coming out in weird ways when you keep putting me in the closet.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think actors in particular are people that have to think a lot about the masks that we as humans wear in the world, and how there's one mask for the world maybe, or different masks for different people or different settings, and who are we when that mask comes off and we're by ourselves. And I think actors have to think about it in particular because they're trying to embody these sort of unmasked people. And I guess there is a school of thought, how could you access the unmasked version of someone else if you can't even access that version of yourself? That sounds helpful and good. Weird follow-up. You had done musical theater, so surely you had some reference point for dance. Was there no dance in 13?
No. What's weird is and this did not help the Golden Boy complex, I really only booked leads. And
so hard for you.
Never really.
So sad for you.
I know. It was really hard.
It's a real struggle.
I was just told growing up, we expect great things from you. Like, you're so wonderful. And
You're so wonderful, you don't have to do the big dance.
When the New York Times calls you smashing at,
exactly.
You know, he was actually 12 years old.
12.
Not 9. Took a while for me to get there.
Yeah, if you had done it when you were 9, you wouldn't have been called smashing. Maybe like half smashing.
Yeah.
So you never had to dance.
I never really had to dance. And it was always like, I think it also just, when you're so young, it just comes more easily.
Yeah.
So it just felt easy. Mm-hmm. And then, so I just assumed, oh, this is easy. And I never learned about the work, which I think around puberty, something starts shifting. And like the way that we wear our masks and we show up and our guards and the roles that we're playing, it all starts to shift a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you can't get away with just being yourself or just be natural. The sense of play has to, like, you actually have to do work to maintain that. Mm-hmm. And I just was never taught that. So I started doing this faux naturalism thing where I'm like, I know what they want, so I'll give it to them. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until, like, pretty recently that I started to get back in touch with the sense of play at all with art. I'd imagine that's actually why a lot of child actors have a hard time transitioning, because mm-hmm. you just don't need the technique when you're young. And then you have to learn the technique.
So interesting.
Which is weird, because, like, why would, like, in what, where else in life is there something that you can be really good at, and then to continue to be good at it in a way that's authentic and true to what the craft is, do you need to then learn a whole bunch of other shit?
Yeah.
To keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
But it's just, like, the nature of the development of your psyche, and I don't know.
When you did 13, did you feel like you were in, like, teenage mode or, like, child mode? I guess that's the whole theory of 13. You're somewhere in between, right?
That I actually was in, I was in between. I wasn't, I was thinking about this the other day. I was like, when did it start?
Because there was, like, Goodspeed version 2, right?
Yeah. There was some of the Golden Boy thing happening there, because it also was weird. I hadn't really, I was with all these people who'd done so many shows. Eamon famously did not love me when we started doing...
Oh, is that true?
We had a tumultuous start.
Really?
Because he was, like,
jealous
the veteran.
Of you?
I think he just thought it was undeserved. He's like, who the hell is this guy rolling in? He's playing the lead. What has he done? He's never done a Broadway show. I've done 6.
Classic Eamon.
And I think that I probably knew, all right, there's these kids here, and they've done so much stuff. And here I am, and I'm, like, rolling in, and I'm like, I'm going to do the best I can do, but...
And that's probably why you booked it.
It's probably why I booked it. It's a good point.
There's an SNL sketch that I think is really funny that's called Cast List or something, that's making fun of the ridiculous nature of high school theater, and Will Ferrell plays a theater teacher, and at one point he asks one of the women... One of the girls, he's like, Samantha, do you want a lead role? And she's like, oh, I don't really care either way. And he's like, and that's why you'll get one. I don't know. I think a lot of in entertainment, again, about this concept of the people who really want it. Like, the distinctions we make between the people who really want it and the people who are just, like, neutral, and how sometimes it can appear that someone who is more indifferent is the one... booking it. Is that making any sense?
It does make sense. It's totally paradoxical, because hypothetically, in when you're watching an actor, you want someone who has that desire, like who wants to be somewhere that they're not. Mm-hmm. But what's also weird is that when that tends to manifest with actors about, like, I need this so I can actually show up as myself, as I always know that I've really been, like, I need this role to get there.
Yeah.
There's a leapfrogging over, like, self-inhabitants that I think is just not, it's not as appealing to watch, because there's not really a sense of presence. Like, you watch a Tom Hardy or, like, a Meryl Streep, it's like, they're not going anywhere.
You know? Yeah. Like, it's true.
Yeah.
Are you a Taylor Swift fan?
I got no beef with T.
Just, she has this song... I find a lot of her not relatable, but one of the most relatable things about her to me, she has this song called This Is Me Trying that's about this feeling. I don't know if you've ever had this feeling. I think it's a uniquely female feeling that, like, all you do is try. You try harder than everyone else and you're pilloried for trying. And it's something I love about her. She has this lyric, I've never been a natural, all I do is try, try, try. And that's one of my favorite lyrics she's ever written, because it's, I don't know, it just hits me. As someone who self-identifies as a trier, and I feel like, I don't know what your experience was, even in school, it was, like, cool to not try, at least at my school. It was, like, cool to be like, oh yeah, I got an A, but I didn't even study. It was, yeah, like, not cool to be like, oh, I studied really hard. Or even in romance, I think, especially in my early 20s, I would say, dating was like a competition between who could care less.
Yeah.
And who could be more indifferent. And that's just so not who I am and who I've ever been. And I feel like a breakthrough in my own life was embracing, I'm never going to be that person that doesn't care, doesn't try.
So. Yeah. That's beautiful. That resonates a lot with me. I tend to be in the kind of binary of I'm trying or whatever. Yeah. I don't care. And I think that trying to hold both the fact that I really do care, but also the acceptance of
the... It's not in your control, yeah.
That's the gold for me.
That's the dream.
That is the dream.
That's the dream. I wish I could get there.
Yeah, we'll never get there.
Maybe someday if we take enough Esalen workshops.
Yeah, maybe if we stop calling it the dream.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, if I take enough Esalen, if I pump enough money into nonprofit.
We talked about Sunday already. I'm obviously involved in that. Is there anything, do you want to talk about that? Or is there anything else you're excited about for 2024, given that it's the beginning of the year?
I'm feeling really good about 2024. I don't know why. In the past, in the last few years, I've been excited about the year to come in a way that's like, well, phew, good riddance with that one. Like, this one's going to be good. And I think I'm less looking at it from an outside-in perspective.
Mm.
Like, I can tell this year's going to be good. I think just more of a focus on the who rather than the what. Like, if the relationships are good, like with myself, with the people I want to collaborate with, and there's a sense of care and ease with compassion with the people, then the work will fall where the work falls. As opposed to making it so much about the thing.
Yeah.
Eamon and I were talking about that the other day. It's so easy for us to get so hyper-focused on the thing that we forget about all the relationships that go into making the thing, and then we inevitably lose track of the meaning of the whole, like, reason why we're even doing art.
Like, I think that's common.
No, we're the only ones, actually. I'm going to push back.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's definitely, like, starting to direct more. I don't know what you've felt as a director, especially in theater. I know I've talked about this before on the show, but I find it weird and disorienting that the director leaves after opening. It's still crazy to me, and it feels like I worked on this Annie tour, and they're just going. They're on their 300-something performance, and I haven't even seen it since September. And every time I get a performance report, I'm like, it hurts a little. I'm like, damn, like, my child is out there doing something, and I have no idea what it is. But that thinking has helped me a lot with what you were talking about. In terms of the process, and therefore the collaborators are more important than the product, per se.
Yeah. I was talking to my brother, because as stressful as making theater is, it's so inherently about the community, just because of its history, and you're all in this room, and it's not about manufacturing presence so it can be screened 8 months to a year later. It either happens in the room or it doesn't. There's a different relationship to truth, I think, in theater and immediacy, obviously. But on film sets, there's just these parameters. And I know that there's time constraints, as we know, when we're directing theater, but it's just, there's a different level of stakes, I think, when it comes to the confines of money and like the hours that you have to shoot and sunlight and all these sort of unusual like rules and parameters that feel arbitrary at times and at odds and conspiring against even the art. And it can be so stressful that it can be hard to listen. Or if you're listening, and when I'm listening, sometimes when I'm in a really like a state of hypervigilance, I'm listening with my logical mind, but like my heart is just completely offline. It's like too freaked out to even show up.
Yeah.
Like I feel like the heart operates on just a different pace than the mind. The mind is like the wind, and it can just go places really fast. You can time travel and do all sorts of stuff. The heart's like slower. It can quicken, but I just feel like for me to really hear someone, I have to slow way down to like emotionally get a sense of where they're at and have a sense of compassion and gratitude. I can't move that fast and have these qualities arise. So on set, it can be really difficult to direct from that place. I was talking to my brother about how, you know, we can spend a year and a half, 2 years even working on a film, and the film could be great, the film could be shit, but the one thing that we actually have control over is the working environment for all of these people. Mm-hmm. And the quality of the time that we have there. And if there is a way for us to invite more warmth and spaciousness and play at the sort of magic that's actually happening on a film set and help the overall stress levels go way, way down for us in our experience, because this is how we're spending our life, but also just for everyone else on set and for the actors so they can absorb that and go, oh, it's not just about getting it done. Then not only will the art be better, but our whole lives are going to be better. Because at the end of the day, we're spending 2% of the time enjoying the final product and 98% of the time in the trenches. So if the trenches are a little less trench-like, good things might happen.
Yeah. I was going to ask this earlier. We touched on this, but I feel like you're also unique because you have been able to really straddle both Broadway and Hollywood in a really interesting way that I don't think a lot of people are able to do. Is unless they come initially from Hollywood. And I feel like you're a Broadway boy who then made that jump. Is there a world to which you gravitate more? Or are they like two equal, that's like a Sophie's Choice situation for you?
Right now, I'm gravitating towards musical theater. I think what happened...
That's good news for us.
It's totally.
You heard it here first.
Everything I've been talking about is solved by just being in relationship to musical theater. I mean, I know that there's obviously ways to still be obsessed with doing it right and not be free in musical theater, but there was a period of time, like a year and a half ago, where I thought I just didn't like acting anymore. And I realized I just had lost, like, the music. I never put it together that my first love wasn't actually acting, it was music. And so it was through music that I learned so many lessons about acting.
Yeah.
And then it was through doing acting in isolation without technique and without help that I started developing a harder relationship with it. And I think it's through music, again, that I'm starting to fall back in love with acting.
I can't believe I didn't mention this before. I've talked about this so many times on the show, but you're probably familiar with this musical theater scholarship concept of the hierarchy of expression. It even comes from Wagner. So it makes total sense, A, that your first love would be music, because I definitely think singing is way more freeing than talking. And B, it makes total sense that you had this experience that you had with movement and with dance, because if you believe that, that is the highest form of freedom and expression according to the hierarchy. So that's fun. This has been such a great conversation. You were saying before we officially started that you and I have never been just the two of us in a conversation. And a huge reason why I do this podcast is because I often try to interview my friends, and I do feel like it's rare that I'm like sitting with my friend talking about process. It's just odd when you go to have dinner or something, be like, Talia, tell me about your process. I would never do that, but it's a fun excuse as someone who likes to talk about that stuff to hear about it. But I hope for listeners that, I know it's been all over the place, but I hope it was still enlightening.
Well, let me just echo that back, because this has just been such a joy.
Well, it's not over yet, so you could have a totally different
You can still gum it up.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's also just funny how important the container is. Setting an intention, having a space and a time to do something. In a way, this is a form of like ritual or ceremony or even something like...
Absolutely.
I just think it's so important. One of the workshops I did at Esalen was on ritual and ceremony What makes that different from just habit and like how to...
What does make it different from habit?
So one of the things that Dae Schildkret, who was the officiant of the workshop, mentioned, he's like, ritual is the art of remembering to remember, or remembering how to remember. And meaning that there's this sense of gnosis that we all have of what it is to be human, and we so easily can escape from that. And there are these threshold moments that we can construct where we decide what is left behind and what we carry through And it's something that's not done automatically, and it takes conscious effort to create a space and a time that demands your attention to be on this one thing, whether it's like the breaking of the glass in a wedding or the tying of a knot or exchanging of rings. Like, something else happens in the metaphorical realm when you do those things, or perhaps when you just press record on a microphone and invite a friend over. There's something, you know,
I'm already worried different. That your technology is so high tech that when it comes to me, I'm not going to be able to edit it, but that's a problem for another day. I'm sure it'll be fine.
It's just going to be like an MP3.
Perfect.
It's going to be an UGS file.
That'll be a fun treat for those listening. I was telling Graham when I was little, I forget how it came up, that my parents wouldn't get me real UGS when I was little, so they got me fake UGS that were called UGS with a Z. And they were pink. I loved them.
Oh, we were recording. So if you really want to go back at the beginning of this...
I'm not going to do that.
You realize you're robbing people of such gold.
I ask almost all my guests this question before my fun little activity. Do you have any advice for aspiring actors or filmmakers who might be listening?
It's funny. My intention for this week was to not give advice unless it was like explicitly solicited, because I've just found myself like freaking pontificating at people,
like that guy.
What guy?
Remember at the bar?
Oh my god, that was so funny.
I know.
Okay, for the listeners out here, this is so good. So there was this fella that we were sitting next to, and this guy just kept giving advice to us about like all of these. He was talking to me about, he was like, where do you live? He's like, I'm in both coasts. And he's like, I tried that. You'll never have a real relationship until you settle down, until you choose a location. You will never find a meaningful relationship. And I was like, oh, okay.
We didn't even know his name. And he was like saying this.
We had no idea who this guy was. And I know Katie fairly well, but as we said, we've never been in the same room alone and been able to do this. And she goes, wow, like, you are so wise. And she kept saying things like that. And I thought, I was like, is she serious? Is she? And it took me a while to realize that you were just trolling him. And that's when I realized, oh my God, we're completely on the same page. But your way of dealing with this rampant soapboxing was...
Someone like that who's in that mode, as you say, there's no way to deal with it. Because you can't engage and be like, oh, tell me why. Because you weren't asking for this advice. You're not interested. And
you just saw what his ego wanted, and you literally just spoon-fed him. You're like, you're so wise.
And yeah. He's like, And then the way you in your brain, like, make sense of it is you're like, it's so funny that he doesn't know that I'm, like, laughing at him.
So good.
That sounds mean. That sounds like I was being mean, but... He was being mean.
He was. He was completely infantilizing me. Also telling me that I can't... It was just... What he was saying was also absurd.
He was really like trying to get into your relationship history. It was very odd.
It was weird. Yeah. But advice.
Do you have advice that's different from that advice? You don't have to have advice.
I can come up with advice. I just saw the actor in The Bear talking about this. Waiting for permission to arrive... and feel like you belong on set or on the platform or wherever is, on some level, it's part of the gig. I think everyone goes through it on some level, but I just wish I had allowed myself to be a complete person. Not saying that I'm not still in process and I'm not still getting better at things and learning skills, but to find ways that when I show up, I'm actually showing up with this essential part of myself that's always been there and that will never go anywhere. As long as I'm alive, there is this flame that I have to bring to the table, no matter how much technique, how little technique, how frazzled or how calm I am, how praised I am for a performance, how much a performance is being panned. Like, it actually has no effect on that essential flame, and it's a gift of service for me to protect it and to show it to people and to reveal it. And I think that's true in relationships. It's true in a whole lot of different things, but particularly in performance, I think there's something sacred about honoring that part of myself and not making my acceptance of who's at the bedrock so contingent, I guess, on a whole bunch of other factors.
Yeah, I think that's well said.
Does that make sense?
No, it's kind of long-winded. It's similar to, I hate how much this trope has been embraced by musical theater people putting it on t-shirts now, but it is true, which is the you are enough trope, but it is true, which is that, like you said, there is a part of each of us that is unique and beautiful and unlike anyone else, and performers have this unique opportunity and ability to reveal a little bit of that to the world. Not too much, because it's still yours. And how beautiful is that to be able to show the world yourself and not compromise it, as you say.
Yeah.
I think that's good advice.
I almost, when I hear you are enough, it's hard for me to find my way into that. But just taking it even more basically, you are. Like, I am. Like, this, the initial art of the handprint on
a cave. Did you read a lot of philosophy at Princeton?
No. Probably should go back and
do. I'm in that, I think, therefore I am. Right?
That's what we're doing as artists.
Yeah.
Whether we're enough or we're not, whether we feel like we're enough or we're not, we're still here, gathering around the fire, telling our stories.
Yep. Oral tradition, still alive today. Yeah.
We've been on a big ride all over the place.
We have been on a big ride. I'll be thinking about that one. This last activity is going to be fun, I promise. It'll be a little different than our last conversation.
Okay.
This section I call Thank You Five, like 5 minutes to places, and it's going to be five rapid-fire questions. So just answer off the top of your head.
Okay.
They're not like one word, though. A lot of favorites, so that might be challenging, but you can always pick a couple. Do you have a favorite fun backstage story about 13 that we might not already know?
Favorite backstage story?
Something that went wrong.
Yeah, a sort of romantic awakening period for me.
That's having nice, never like though.
Had any romantic partner at all until
were
then.
You third you were 15?
15. Yeah, 16 when we made it
to the Broadway.
The Broadway, yeah.
That's so fun. I remember just being so jealous of you guys.
Yeah.
Because my parents wouldn't let me audition for anything professionally. They were like,
what? Why?
They were like, we want you to have a childhood. We want you to be a normal kid. No. And they really cared about school. So they were like, you're not going to get homeschooled. You're not going to get a tutor. You're not going to go to PCS or one of these like fake schools. Mm-hmm. We care about school. I think I went to one professional audition they let me go on, which was to do that play Blackbird, which is about a 12-year-old who gets molested, and I was 12. And I remember it was my first professional audition ever, sitting in the room. I'm friendly, like I'm a friendly person, but I didn't really know how people behaved in audition waiting rooms. So I remember I went around and I was like, hi, what's your name? Like every single person. And then being like, how old are you? And discovering that everyone was like 18 or 19, except for me. And then I remember they asked my parents if I would be willing to take my braces off for the role. And they were like, no. Anyway, so I was very jealous. I remember hearing that 13 was happening. And I was like, I'm so fucking jealous of all these people that get to do this.
I remember something that happened. It really just goes back more to my tumultuous relationship with dance. But back when 13 was a two-act show, it ended with a big banger of a number called Here I Come. Before, for one performance, JRB had me come over to try to save the two-act structure, taught me being a geek, and we put it in previews that night. That was freaky.
Wow.
It was very short-term memory I got it out. There was like a couple lyric fuck-ups, but you know.
That's Broadway.
That's Broadway, baby. So here I come. The idea behind this number was like, it was in an arcade outside of the movie theater where the Bloodmaster was playing, and the through line thematically was Dance Revolution. Mm. And all these DDR things were like projected on the ground, and I was supposed to dance. Now, the person who did the performances on the matinees, Corey Snide, was one of the Billy Elliots.
Oh.
And I sucked at dancing. And it barely worked with Corey doing it. And I knew if it looked like that with Corey, who's like so freaking good.
Yeah.
I just knew what I looked like out there. And it was just such a mess. And I just remember Eamon just watching me dance going, what the hell? It was like almost, he was like, yeah, that's right. Like,
was that in
crash
your,
and burn.
Was that in your phase of him not liking you, or were you guys friends yet?
No, we weren't. We were not friends. You know what? It originated because we both auditioned for The Little Prince. And we were in the final four for Little Prince at 12.
There you go.
And I guess we were 11. And actually, there's a photograph of me. We found it. Me, Eamon, and two other kids. That was like in the art section. It might have been like the front page of the frickin' art section in the Times about the process of casting.
Oh, like finding the Little Prince.
The quest to like crown a prince and pluck a rose.
Yeah.
And I was just like, first of all, like, how did they not have anything else to write about that week? But also how bizarre that one of my best friends, before we even knew each other, there was a photo of us singing around a piano.
That's
like,
crazy.
In the paper. It was
Do you
so
know
bizarre.
Who the other people are?
I split the role with one of the other kids who got it, and I don't know who the other kid was. I remember that audition, though. My mom would have me just learn everything for the show, like if I was auditioning for it. I realized why it was easy for me to get roles, because my mom just knew what was up. She's like, all right, cool, we'll start preparing for this like a month before, and felt very easy, and I just knew everything. And so when I went in there, like, hey, can you go out and learn this song? I was like, okay. And I'd go out and I'd be like, I've sang this song like 20 times. And I'd come in and then I do it, and they're like, wow, this kid is like really incredible. But it was like, I actually was just out preparing everyone, and I had no idea that's not what everyone else did.
I think that's a secret to life in general.
I think you're right.
This is a fun one, I think. Who do you think would win in a fight? Evan Goldman, Prince Eric, Zach Florick, or Nick St. Clair?
Jesus. Evan Goldman. Mm. I think he's just...
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
I just think that he has the most
Your
drive
connection
out of anyone.
To Judy. Do you have any dream roles, or have they not been written yet?
There's actually a film that I'm directing with my brother, a psychological thriller that I've been really passionate about, and I've recently been thinking that I'm actually just going to play one of the
That's
lead
so
characters
fun.
That I'm like, yeah, really excited about. Yeah. So that, Colburn. I love the music in Bridges. Yeah.
So good.
Yeah. I'd like to do that someday.
You're going to have to wait a bit, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. I guess part of the point of why that show works is it's a last... It's they're at the age where it's either it's now or never.
In the movie, they're even older.
Yeah. Clint. He's pushing it.
Still sexy, though.
Still sexy. Still sexy. Still sexy. But it might be time for him to settle down.
But when I saw Bridges with Steve Pasquale, I was like, yeah, he can get it. Do you have any dream collaborators?
Other than you?
Okay.
I would love to work with Paul Thomas Anderson.
Good answer.
I think it'd be really fun to work with Wes Anderson just for the whimsy, and I'd love to just get to know him and see how much of his the visual realm that he creates and the sense of harmony and like the humor that comes from people not really hearing each other and the awkwardness of timing, like how much that comes from his own personality and his family dynamic and everything. I'm really interested in that. Gosh, there's so many actors. Meryl Streep and Daniel Day are like, I would just love to. Tom Hardy.
Good answers. My last question, I ask every guest a version of this. What to you is an actor's essential? So that could be as simple as a water bottle, or it could be like joy. So literally or metaphorically.
For me, it's just moving the body and like just getting the center of my being down from my head.
That's been like the theme of our episode, I feel like.
Body, movement.
Movement.
Yeah.
It's so important.
Yeah. I think it's really under examined in the age of
Have you
technology.
Ever done the or researched the Laban acting technique or Suzuki acting technique?
Oh, is that where like certain positions bring
yeah,
up?
Yeah, and Suzuki is like marching a lot. It's movement based. I did this summer in the Berkshires that was like an acting apprenticeship, and the person who ran it was obsessed with Suzuki. Some acting methods believe it's all about like backstory and head stuff, and this was all movement based. Suzuki was so much marching. I couldn't even tell you why, but we had to do an hour of marching every single morning.
What?
This summer. Yeah, like the army.
Oh my God.
It was crazy. I don't think
Is it Japanese or Suzuki?
Yeah. It comes originally. I'll do some research, but I had one of my friends from that program on the pod recently, and I was like, "What's your favorite memory of that summer?" And she was like, "Probably doing an hour of marching every day." And I just blocked that out. Like, I couldn't believe I hadn't thought about it in 10 years.
Oh my God. Wow. Yeah, I gotta check. What's the other one called?
Laban. Which
Laban,
is
Laban, yes.
As you
right.
say, it's like movements. It would be like, is this character like flicking? Or it's movement-based subtext rather than like head-based.
Is it connected with intention?
Yeah. So, oh, when they say this line, instead of being like, oh, what's her verb with this line? Oh, is she investigating? Is she seducing? Whatever. It would be like, is she flicking? Is she... For some reason, that's the only move. There are like five terms
yeah.
that they use. And you do the movement, you know, before you speak the line.
In Alexander, they talk about there's like flicking, gliding. That's really interesting. I was thinking last year about how some emotions, at least for me, could be diluted down to temperatures in the body. Like, what's hot and what's cold? Like, where energy is moving?
That's interesting.
And rage might, or fear for one person might be, like, coldness on the neck. Or
yeah.
rage might be, you know.
Rage is interesting because I feel like it's different, right? Sometimes it feels hot, but sometimes you read a novel and they describe it as, like, a cold rage.
Yeah. Imagine like an ice cube or something in the center of your stomach and your gut. It does something like physiologically. They're just
it's
thinking about it. I'll get back to you once I've developed it.
Yes,
into a,
the Phillips
the cheat
technique.
Sheet.
The Phillips technique. Graham, this has been so fun. I hope it was fun for you.
It was fun for me.
I hope it was different than the video game podcast.
It was. It was a lot more questions that I actually had answers to.
That's nice. I want to plug this production of Sunday in the Park with George that you are about to do along with friend of the pod and my dear friend Talia Suskauer, and also friend of the pod and our dear friend Eamon Foley is directing and choreographing at the Axelrod Arts Center out in Deal, New Jersey. And I believe it runs from March 8th through March 25th. But it's not like 8 shows a week, so check out the calendar online. I'm sure it's there. But everyone listening, if you're a Graham fan, and I'm sure you will be by the end of this very long podcast, you should come see it because I think it's going to be really amazing. And I was talking to someone about this recently, either Talia or Eamon, just saying that we've never been like close, but I feel like you're someone who pops up in my life randomly a lot. We went to college together and took this class together. And then separately from you, I became really close with Eamon, and then Grind started and there was that. And then of course we have a number of mutual friends in common. Certainly you'll appreciate this. When I went to Princeton, our best family friends were like obsessed with The Good Wife, and they were like, you have to find the kid who plays Zach Florick. You have to find him and tell us what he's like. And I don't know what my expectations were, but want to say for all listeners that Graham is such a kind, great person, which I'm sure you can tell from the pod, and very talented to boot. Thank you for listening. It's going to be a great year of call time. Last year was such a great year.